Good morning, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Espresso Epilogues.
We're here on a very special occasion with
our very first guest, Godessolo, for a philosophy episode. Godessolo, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Godessolo. I do philosophy stuff and glad to be here.
He's one of our favorite philosophy creators. But we thought there's no better person to be our first guest ever, and we can talk philosophy.
Okay, so we're each going to ask you a few icebreaker questions, if that's okay. Very sure. Random ones for our audience. So my first icebreaker question to you is, what is your coffee order?
Oh, this is awkward. I don't drink coffee. So
we kicked him out of the podcast.
I'm in the wrong place.
I saw the name Espresso, and I was like, you know, that's just terrible. So I don't drink coffee. I drink tea. I drink a lot of bubble tea.
Okay, we do love it.
No coffee. Yeah.
No coffee, huh? Okay.
No.
Can we switch you? Can we bring you onto our side? Is it just a hatred toward coffee?
Well, you're more than welcome to try, I suppose. But I don't know. I feel as though I have enough addictions as it is. Philosophy is probably one of them. And bubble tea is another one. And chocolate's the third one. I feel as though if I add coffee to the whole thing, it's just going to be a mess. I'll go bankrupt. It'll be a whole thing. So
I feel like book and coffee just hits different than book and boba, you know what I mean? But
no, I don't actually, but okay. Yeah.
Like book and boba is good. You're good.
Yeah. So yeah, no coffee.
Honestly, book and boba could be your podcast name because it sounds kind of good.
It does.
Like we won't be suing.
That's not bad. I'll put a pin in it. We'll come back to it.
Yeah. You went through every emotion on the spectrum just there, contemplating it.
Yeah, because I was like, there's something there, actually. Yeah.
Right?
Little B&B for the morning. Whoa, that's actually pretty good. Anyways, that's all. That's better.
Exactly. Honestly, like kind of a trademark it. Okay, love it. Do you have another icebreaker?
Okay, so if you were stranded on an island, we'll phrase it differently.
No, I love that.
If you were stranded on an island...
Yeah.
Theoretically, hypothetically, and you had one book with you that you could pick beforehand, what would it be?
Yeah.
I don't know my answer. That's a good question.
Okay, so that's a tough one.
I know.
Well, on the one hand, since Kierkegaard is like really difficult to understand, I feel as if I had one of his books for like a lifetime on an island, by the end of my life, I might understand it. If I like read it for like 10 years, that's because Kierkegaard is kind of really annoying. But I mean, honestly, I do like the Symposium. It is fun to read. It is fun to reread. It's pretty short. I don't know. I think I'd get bored with that pretty easily.
That would be a tough one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Do you have your answer?
No.
Can you think of any?
How to Build a Raft. That's not a philosophical work.
That's fair. That's not a philosophical work.
Thinking the manual.
It'd probably be some metaphysical work, you know, so that I would kind of separate myself from the five senses.
While we're contemplating love, Aspa is building a raft to get us out of there. So you need a balance.
Yeah. Oh, are we all on this island together? Is that
rationally
what?
Rational.
Yeah. That's a tough. Yeah. I'll sleep on that one.
Maybe I would take, I mean, realistically, potentially something like War and Peace so that I would be like, you know what? I had a lot of dead time. So I finally got that one out of the way.
Yeah. So Crime and Punishment. Yeah. As well.
Crime and Punishment. Yeah. Crime and Punishment.
She binged it, in other words. She read it in a week.
That's impressive. I haven't even gotten to chapter. I am
struggling with Crime and Punishment.
I loved it. We say this in every episode almost. We're like, guys, read Crime and Punishment. Let us know what you think. But yeah, maybe I take War and Peace because I can't think of a better time than when I'm stranded with no distractions on an island. Probably not a vibe to be reading if it's like a tropical island, you know, War and Peace, but what are you going to do?
Yeah. So we've got Tolstoy, Plato, and...
Raft
building. There we go.
Not bad. Yeah. Raft is great. You know, his early work is incredible. It's nice.
Good.
Let's do it.
So today, you guys, what we're talking about is the philosophy of love and maybe philosophy of beauty and existentialism. And actually how this came up is, I think, because Godessolo, you and I met up in London the day before Valentine's Day. So we were like, oh, this is a good time for this, even though it's now been like 3 weeks, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's timeless, right? So we can just, we can just talk about that anytime. I mean, Plato was talking about that 2,500 years ago, and everything is still really relevant. So who are we to talk about it 2 weeks after Valentine's Day?
Yeah, yeah. Facts.
So we've chosen three books, three texts to kind of go off of and see where we end up. One is Plato's Symposium, which, oh my God, I loved. The other is Kierkegaard, Works of Love. Then Gnesla, you're going to have to carry us through because Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Like, that was hard. And the third one is White Nights by Dostoevsky.
Yeah. Beautiful stuff.
Where should we start? Let's do it.
Plato would be a good place to begin.
Let's start with the Symposium.
The Symposium.
Okay. Aspa, would you maybe like to kind of present Symposium?
I don't know enough about the Symposium to be able to present
You can
that
maybe
way.
Do White Nights.
Okay, I'll do White Nights.
Okay, so I can do Symposium. Good. You can do Kierkegaard.
Amen.
Gnesla. And yeah, Aspa can do White Nights just as a little intro. Okay. So the Symposium by Plato is a great little text that basically, okay, that I annotated the hell out of for some reason, which I don't often do. And it's basically, it's a little dinner party in ancient Greece with a few philosophers and other things. And they're all taking turns, basically giving speeches as a eulogy to love and kind of just going off saying a speech in honor of love. And each one of them presents to them what love is and how it relates to human nature and how they see love, the good, the bad about it. They kind of just, yeah, in a very vague way, they all just end up going on a tangent in any direction they want. Then they praise each other, and then it's on to the next guy, like clockwise. And it's a great text. It's only 80 pages, and it's great for so many reasons. One is because it feels so contemporary. It's so easy to read and easy to understand, I think, for what it is. And the other is because it's genuinely kind of funny at parts. Like, I don't know if that was just me or my translation, but like, I had fun.
It's pretty funny. Yeah.
When did you first read it?
I think it was like 2 years ago. I heard it referenced in, actually the first time I probably heard of it, there's this random thing. There's this Family Guy episode where they kind of just have a throwaway line on Plato's Symposium. So that was technically the first time I heard of it, like 1,000 years ago. And more recently, I was reading a book called The Philosopher Queens, which is just a nice little book that has annotated biographies on some female philosophers. And it starts off with some ancient ones, and Diotima's in there. And it's like, yeah, Diotima, we don't know much about her, but like, you know, she plays a super important part in Plato's Symposium and about love or whatever. And I was like, oh, this sounds pretty nice. And so I sought out the symposium and I read the whole thing and I was like, oh, this is like the best thing ever. Like, where has this been my whole life? So that's how I kind of stumbled into the symposium.
I'm glad you love it as much as I loved it, because it was just, I don't know, just better than I expected, I think. And also Diotima, it's funny that you mentioned, because she does just have a really big part in it, because Socrates is like, look, this is everything I learned from Diotima. And she schooled me, basically. But I didn't know anything about her. Like, do you know anything about her after reading Philosopher Queens?
Well, it's one of those things where it depends on who you ask, I suppose, if she was an actual person or if she was kind of invented for the story. There's obviously a lot of significance that she is a woman and that she as you say, schools Socrates, like really, because like she kind of gives Socrates a taste of his own medicine, which is incredible, because that's usually what Socrates does to everyone else, asking all the questions and making them confused. But like in Symposium, like Socrates is the one who just is confused. And she's like so sassy, so which I find incredible. Is like after she says a bunch of stuff, she's like, these are the simple secrets of love. It's like, even you can get this, Socrates. Like, it's simple for you.
And I'm like, bro. She's like, now try to focus really hard, Socrates, and you might get this next point.
Yeah. I'm like, I love this. So as far as what we know about her, it kind of, some people wonder if she actually existed. But I think there's a case to be made either way that she might have been real. But in either case, she's a vibe.
Do you want to kind of, I mean, I think it's interesting the part about Socrates, how he does that to everyone. Well, I found it, like, he's so annoying in a way. I mean, maybe for anyone who hasn't read it, it's like, the thing Socrates does is kind of, he can twist other people's words to make them agree to whatever he wants to in a really annoying way.
Yeah.
And at some point, is it, so the thing with this book is that we, like, I don't know how to pronounce the names in English. I know how to pronounce them in Greek.
But do like, it.
Well, Alcibiades, which is maybe Alcibiades or something like that.
Alcibiades is kind of how we say it in English.
Alcibiades. Yeah. See, I would have not.
I like yours better than this. Just do yours all the time.
Alcibiades. Yeah.
Ooh,
well, I think it was him who was like, he came in and he's like, came in at the end of the dinner party and he's like, guys, this is what Socrates does. Every time I allow myself to listen to him, I end up agreeing to terrible things, so I don't allow myself to let him speak because I know what he's going to do. And it's like,
yeah,
he describes people around him as being like spellbound by Socrates, which is interesting,
yeah,
because he's so good at rhetoric, basically.
Yeah. I think it's one of the reasons why I tend to, as a blanket recommendation, if anyone wants to get into philosophy, I recommend the Symposium, mostly just because you get a lot of insight into Socrates, not only as a person, but kind of as a philosopher, part of his method, because at least according to Plato, Socrates is literally the philosopher. He's the blueprint of what a philosopher should be like. And in the Symposium, you just get a lot of cute little things about his personality. Like at the beginning, he's like, walking to this party, and then he runs into this guy, and the guy's like, oh, Socrates, what are you doing? So I'm going to this party. Do you want to come with me? Even though he wasn't invited. But Socrates is like, yeah, that's fine. We'll sugar it out on our way. But then on the way, Socrates just stops to think about something and like has the guy go on to the party alone. And it's like, this guy wasn't invited. He was only coming because of you.
And then the guy who's hosting the party, Agathon, right? He's like, where's Socrates? Should we go get him? And Aristodemus, who was walking there with Socrates, is like, no, he does that. Like, he's just standing in the yard of a random house contemplating something. Don't bother him. He's going to come at some point. And they're like, are you sure? Go get him. And he's like, no, just let him. He does it.
He does. And then he just shows up. And then they do the whole thing. And then at the end, Socrates stays up all night talking about philosophy. And then the way the text puts it, like, in the morning, he just kind of gets up and goes and takes a bath and then just goes about his day. And it's like, he spent all night talking and then he just kept going. That's Socrates.
Icon.
Icon. He's so annoying. But I love him so much. Socrates is my guy. I love that guy.
Really? Yeah, Socrates is your guy?
Low key though, I'm a Socrates fan, I have to say.
Yeah. Socrates never really released any of his works because we know Socrates through Plato because he was Plato was his pupil. So if anything, all of the philosophy we know is Plato's interpretation of it.
That's
so Socrates
true.
Yeah. could have had,
yeah.
you know, a much more complex train of thought than we know.
Yeah,
that's true.
It's possible.
Thank you for recommending this, by the way, because as a Greek, I kind of have the tendency to blow it off a little bit, which I'm shamed to admit. But given how entertaining both of you have made it seem, it's something I'm going to pick up for sure. Today.
Yeah,
it's kind of ridiculous.
The name doesn't do it justice.
We are reading it in English and not in Greek. You might as well.
Yeah, I was just about to ask that.
Well, ancient Greek.
I don't know why I did that. I didn't even think about it. I was just like, yeah, let's get the Penguin Great Ideas edition. And then it was like, I mean,
you should read both to compare it. See
maybe.
If the translation does it justice.
Yeah.
The thing is that the modern Greek, well, I only did 2 years of ancient Greek in school, so I can't read ancient Greek, but the modern Greek version is still a translation.
That's
so
true.
The English one is a translation too. In a way, you're still in both cases reading an interpretation, like a translation. And this one was really good. So if you guys want to pick this up, the Penguin Books Great Ideas one was really perfect.
If you do read it in Greek, though, and you discover anything cool, let me know.
Ooh, yeah, maybe I'll do my own deep dive.
Yeah.
Smart. Yeah. I wanted to ask you guys about what did you think in regard to the protagonist in Symposium, given that it was such a hyper-masculine society. It was such a hyper-masculine society in the way it was looked upon women, that they were certainly inferior to men and weren't worthy of an education as men were. The fact that a female protagonist comes in and is able to put Socrates in his place, that's interesting to think of, to say the least.
Is that why you say that maybe? Well, okay. So when we were talking, Odessa, you told me that there's like a whole theory that the whole thing is just like Plato trolling them. I see how that could be played with Diotima being made up to kind of school Socrates in that context.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot to say on that because it is kind of hard to say. I think I was trying to remember where I read this and if it actually did suggest that Plato was just trolling everyone, or if kind of what I'm remembering is something that I read that is just wondering how much of it is a joke, because there's the whole story about human beings being joined together or whatever. And that whole story, I mean, it's cute and all, but it is fairly ridiculous. So some people just think that there's like some sort of inside joke going on. There's a bunch of inside jokes. And so I don't know if it's the case that the whole thing is Plato trolling. But if it is, though, Diotima's speech is actually really incredible and actually like stupidly profound. And it defines what it means to be a philosopher. And it serves as the speech that Socrates says, she taught him everything he knows about love. And like the only thing that he even knows is love, really. And so her speech is kind of incredible. So I don't think the whole thing's a joke, but some parts do feel a bit trolly. And I think if you were to historically analyze it, I don't know, that's a whole different conversation. People wonder, did this actually happen? Who was actually there? Some of the dates are a bit weird. So clearly there's some creative license taken in some places, but in either case, the philosophy is fire, sauce.
What I got from Diotima's speech, and tell me if that's what you got from it too, because I mean, it's definitely the most, well, it's probably the, yeah, not the best one. I don't know. I definitely had my favorite speeches in the symposium. Wait, let me see which one my actual favorite was. I think it was, wait, I need to see, because I put hearts around it in the book.
Nice.
Agathon, I think. Mm. Yeah. But because, mostly because it was like well-spoken. It was beautiful rather than the meaning. But Diotima's kind of endpoint seemed to me to be that the end goal and the function of love is for humans to be able to reach a level where they are able to grasp an ultimate type of beauty that exists in and of itself, incomparable to anything else. And being able to grasp that puts you in that sort of higher state of being, of existence. And that's the function of love. Is that what you got from it as well?
Yeah. So it's definitely that. It's like you fall in love with one person and it's like you only have eyes for them, and that's great, but that's just the first step on this longer journey to understanding what true love is and true beauty is. So from this one person, they give you kind of a window into understanding what the meaning of beauty is and the meaning of love. And then when you understand the meaning of true beauty, true love, you almost don't even need the love from individuals anymore. It's like you fall in love with love itself, and you become you become immortal in this way. It's like being in love all the time. So you don't need anyone. You don't need any one specific person. You're just constantly in love with
everything. Love of others, then she puts as a higher one, love of ideas and being able, as she says, give birth to ideas like Homer.
Yep.
And then love of love in itself, which is the higher state.
And I think in her speech, we get the meaning of what it means to be a philosopher in this sense, because all the speeches everyone gives is on Eros, the god of love, and the idea is that love is a god. And they give speeches on how he's a god and how he's super cool and all of that jazz. But Diotima talking to Socrates is like, Eros is not a god. And Socrates is like, oh, does that mean he's a man? And then Diotima is like, no, he's neither god nor man. He's in between. So Eros is in between God and man. Yeah. And in being in between, she says that Eros is desire. That's what it means to love. Love is desire. You're in between two things. And that's the definition of a philosopher, because she says that if a person has wisdom, they aren't going to desire wisdom. You can't desire what you already have. Yeah. And so in this sense, the gods aren't even philosophers. The gods can't do philosophy, which I think is incredible, because they already have wisdom. They already have beauty. They don't need it. But a philosopher is someone who is in between wisdom and ignorance. So you don't have wisdom, but you're not ignorant. So you know you need it, but you don't have it yet. So you're in between. It's the desire for wisdom. That's what it means to be a philosopher. You're constantly in the in-between. And so love for Diotima is this desire for the beautiful. You want to gain beauty forever. Because if you want something good, you want to obtain it forever. the love for beauty is a love for immortality, and you become immortal by creating ideas and giving birth to things. And so that's kind of that's what it means to be a philosopher in this sense. You're desiring something that once you get it, it makes you no longer a philosopher, which is incredible. But yeah, it's the desire.
I liked that idea that, well, you know, she went a lot into how love is about generating immortality and mm-hmm. at first through like reproduction and just genuinely keeping things going, and then through giving birth to ideas, and eventually how it's about the fact that when you love something, once you acquire it, it's not like, I don't know even know how to put it, but like that when you love something, what you actually want and desire is to love it forever. So it's yep. the forever of it all that is key yep. to the act of loving. And the way that the way it's written and explained, I think is really eloquent and really good for such a short book. Like really yep. well done. Like I'm struggling to explain it now, but it's so clear when you're reading, if you just really take yep. your time with every point they're making.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what do you think about this? So would it be worth it to kind of fall in love with love and then just be enamored by everything all the time at the expense of being in a relationship with anyone? Mm-hmm. Is this a good life to live? Because this is kind of the highest form of love that Plato's talking about. It's loving everything. And so yeah. in doing so, you become self-sufficient in a way, which is part of why the symposium is fun, because you get a lot of Socrates' weirdness, but it's kind of implied that it's because he's a philosopher that he can endure like everything. Alcibiades yeah. tells a story of Socrates at war, and he's like, yeah, like temperatures don't even affect Socrates. Like if it's cold, he'll go outside barefoot. He doesn't care. If he's going into battle, he'll go into battle. Doesn't care. He can drink as much as he wants without ever getting drunk. He doesn't care.
In that story, there's a part where he was like, wait, he's describing Socrates at war, as you said. And he's like, I yeah. noticed that he's walking along there, just as he does here in Athens, swaggering and looking from side to side, calmly looking out both for friends and enemies, obvious to everyone, even from a long distance, that if anyone tackled him, he'd put up a tough resistance. And you're just yep. picturing Socrates like, as he says, swaggering and looking from side to side, like, yeah.
Yep. He's just chilling, vibing. Really. He's just vibing. And the idea is that Socrates, I mean, there's like literally one of my favorite stories in all of philosophy ever in this work about Alcibiades trying to seduce Socrates. He's like, he invites him over and they cuddle for a bit. And he's like, yo, Socrates, like, just say the word, bro. And like, we can go all night. And then Socrates is like, yeah, great, 100%. And then he just doesn't. He just falls asleep. And then he just keeps like, it just keeps ghosting Alcibiades. It's incredible. And the idea is that Socrates is so just a philosopher. He doesn't need anything except his philosophy. And so I guess the question in this sense is that like, does this actually seem worth it, right? So you fall in love with love and you're self-sufficient onto yourself and you don't really need per se a partner in life anymore.
I'll tell you that I'm really in between, because another idea in Symposium is the whole thing you mentioned about how humans used to have, you know, four arms, four legs, blah, blah, blah. Zeus cut them in half because they were getting too annoying and he didn't know what yep. else to do with them. And then we yep. spent the rest of our lives looking for our other half. And so I don't remember, is it Aristophanes that says this speech? And
sounds about right.
The point is that this is why love is the pursuit of wholeness, because we used to be whole and we are now looking for wholeness again. I don't love that idea, because I don't think that romantic love is the pursuit of wholeness, or I just think we have maybe expanded that concept to be maybe beyond where it should be in a way. Like, I think the goal is to be able to find wholeness in yourself, and then romantic love can just complement that in a really, really beautiful way. So I think that relates to what you're asking in a way. It's like, I think if you are in love with love itself and you've reached a state where somehow you feel whole and fulfilled in yourself, that is a really great and high state to be able to be in. I don't know if you were telling me that that would mean I would never have any romantic love in my life, I don't know if I would like that. Do you get what I mean? But what do you guys think?
I think what is something, I remember our philosophy teacher in high school showed us a little video to conceptualize this allegory. the little human ball because that's how it tumbled.
Yes.
There were eight limbs, two sets of genitals, two heads. But what stood out to me the most was the fact that when Zeus did split these up, the fact that it went from one soul to two. So in a sense, you're kind of looking for your soulmate, your other half. So there is like there that would also reinforce the idea of dualism.
Do you think we have a single soulmate? I tend to think we have maybe multiple.
But I was also, that as well. But what I was getting to was the idea that like we have, there's a separation between our physical body and, you know, our soul.
Yeah, I love that.
And so we're in a constant search for like what will complete our soul.
What do you think of Goodesla's question? Like, if you could reach a state where you're just in love with love and that's it, you feel fulfilled about it and you don't need anyone else, is that a good life?
I certainly think that would be like it is the a highest good life, level. Probably. That would be the highest level of consciousness, if anything, the highest state of being.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I'm too accustomed to society feeling the need that I certainly...
It's that we can't even see that as good of a life as it would be because we love too much. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We definitely love a version of love. And Socrates' thing is it's incredible. And there's a bit more we can say on it. But real quick, since you mentioned soulmates and we might have multiple. So what makes someone a soulmate? What makes them different from just, I don't know, your bestest friend of all time? Or are all of your best friends soulmates?
To me, it's that, no, not all of your best friends are soulmates. I mean, the way I see it now, which might change later in life, is that you can tell when you might have many best friends or many people you've connected with in your life, but you're like, okay, there are these specific people that I've just connected with to a point that feels like I can't explain it in the way that I should be able to, in a way. It's maybe kind of, it feels like a soul compatibility that you just can both tell and acknowledge. And it's like, even if you have a lot of people that you connect really well with, I think it's just a different type of, a different level of connection where the way that it feels, you're both kind of like, are we soulmates? Do you know what I mean? I mean, that's kind of how I see it. But how do you see it?
Yeah. I don't know. I guess in the most idealistic sense, I like to think that all of us kind of exist with parts of ourselves that we can't understand. Like parts of our souls are like written in a language that we can't read or something. And I think that there are some people out there who, for whatever reason, can read them and tell us things that we couldn't have learned on our own about who we are, which I think is a very intimate thing to be able to do with somebody else.
Oh, I agree so I think with that.
That's very sweet.
It's like the people that come into your life and you can see directly how they allowed you to learn things about yourself that you weren't able to see before, even if they didn't consciously.
Yeah. And as I think if a soulmate is anything, it would be that. And it doesn't necessarily have to be romantic, but I do think that there's something a bit higher with romantic relationships in this sense, just because if at the very least a romantic partnership is a friendship first with romantic stuff. So I think it's kind of weird to compare like friendships with romantic partners, because like in a perfect world, your romantic partner is also your friend. And so there's all the joys of friendship and some other stuff. And so I think that in that sense, that version of a soulmate is pretty cool. But if I were to define soulmate, that's probably what I would go for.
Do you think we have multiple soulmates? Also for you, could you answer your own question about, you know, loving love?
Yeah. One of my biggest weaknesses is somebody asking me my own questions. I hate it when that happens.
You dug yourself into a hole by coming on this podcast.
You dug your own grave.
Whoops. I like asking the questions. Just don't ask me my questions.
We love asking questions.
Anyways, well,
I could give you my point while you think if you want.
Go for it. Perfect.
What was the great? I don't understand why this allegory that seems so superficial and funny and comical at this point, the one when we're two people basically in one body and we're split. For that reason, that stood out to me a little more. then the idea of soulmates, the way we've westernized it, you know, in pursuit of your soulmate, the person you're going to marry and inevitably have a family with, grow old with. But it's the idea that, like, you're not chasing them to reunite them to be one body. It's you're chasing them so that they complete your soul. That, to me, stands out the most.
Yeah, I think on the loving love and then being self-sufficient. On the one hand, I do. There are some things about my life that I do just kind of for funsies, and they happen to go with Socrates' vibes, and I have kind of weird quirks here and there. And I feel as though if the final level of whatever I have going on is the Socrates life, where you're really just vibing, you're just kind of going. And it's slightly different from Stoicism, because Socrates is not like dead inside. He's a passionate man, clearly. And he still gets to show his passions to everyone. But at the same time, he knows what he's about. He knows what he's doing. And he's just, he's just going with the vibes. And that's like my thing. I love going with the vibes. The highest point of vibing is kind of just this self-sufficiency. I have no qualms with that. I don't think that would be too bad.
You do give off that vibe, the kind of just, you know, honestly vibing. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Yeah.
You seem very present, grounded.
That is true. You do seem very present.
I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I try.
Yeah.
I practice every morning. I look in the mirror. I'm like, okay, we're here. Yeah.
Here we are.
Really?
Yeah. No, I don't. No, I don't.
We have our own equivalent practices every day.
Yeah. Ooh, what are they?
I have my 100-day meditation streak. Thank you very much.
Really?
First time in my life I managed to do over like a month straight. It's very nice. It's very nice. I definitely find myself being more present. And I've tried so many practices to be more present throughout my life ever since I started focusing on mindfulness maybe 6 years ago when I realized that's a thing. And I think it's about finding truly what works for you personally. Like, I had a friend still have a friend. He's still here, but he... Alex, for reference, he used to he's not listening to this podcast ever, but I'll tell him we gave him a shout out. But he used to have this thing on his phone, like a bong that would sound at random times during the day, like a bong noise, and it was basically to remind him to be present. I remember maybe after high school, he would do that. And I was like, wow, we would just be chilling and there would be like a bong noise. And he was like, oh, that's my reminder to be in the present moment. I was like, that's cool. That's an interesting thought. Yeah. Like everyone has, you know, you need to find what works for you. But that, we try.
Yeah. And so I don't know if it's the Socrates-ness of it all, if that's like the ultimate form of being present or if it's something else. But I think I can understand why Plato might think that this is the ultimate form. And it's also kind of part of the reason why I recommend Symposium as like an introductory thing, because I know a lot of people start with existentialism stuff, you know, Camus, whatever it is, which is great, obviously, that's a vibe. But I think it's nice to know what the existentialists had beef with. And most of it is this stuff. There's like this idea of understanding objective beauty and objective love and all of that jazz. Yeah. It's like, what are we talking about? We're talking about the theoretical form of love. And so you love an individual so you can understand the idea of love. Like the existentialists are like, that's just, what are we doing here? It's like the love that you feel in the moment with someone, like that's it. That's what's
There's
important.
Nothing to
that's,
figure out.
Yeah. That's the beauty like, there.
That is the meaning.
Yeah. And so I think existentialism is more vibey when you know that this is what they were kind of moving away from, because Plato does get kind of a bad rep for focusing too much on his ideas. He's like, his head's in the cloud a lot. And so we're here theorizing about this form of love. Like, what even is this? I mean, yes, the way Diotima puts it, it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. But what does this really mean, you know? And the Socrates life, again, I think the Socrates life is a vibe. Like, temperature doesn't affect this man. He doesn't even need to sleep. He doesn't eat sleep. He has philosophy.
Doesn't get drunk, so, no matter how much wine he drinks.
Exactly. Like they say that no one outdrinks him, but no one has ever seen him drunk. And so, it's There's a lot of interesting stuff there.
I think that's why I really maybe feel existentialism sometimes closer to my heart, because it's Symposium is really fun to read and one of my favorite texts for many reasons, but I think it's harder to, well, it's, I think you like it because you understand it. And it's like, wow, you know, wonderful that they express these ideas in this way and you can understand them and think of what you agree with and don't agree with. But existentialism feels a lot more personal and subjective.
Yep.
The Symposium and this type of philosophy is more like, well, these are Socrates' ideas and he's very convincing, but do you actually agree with them? Like, what do you think of them? Whereas existentialism, I think, prompts you to focus more on your own experience rather than to the objective idea that someone's presenting. What was your favorite part in the Symposium? Do you have any that stood out?
Well, kind of as I said, all of Socrates' quirks are nice. Yeah, him ghosting Alcibiades, that's nice. That's just incredible. Alcibiades being like really down bad as he arrives drunk at the end and it's just like ranting about Socrates. It's like, bro, this guy is just the worst. He just exposed everything. Socrates is just like there, just like, And when Socrates shows up, like at the beginning, he does this thing where he wants to sit next to the most handsome guy in the room because that's like his thing. And I'm pretty sure there's one point where like Alcibiades comes in and he's mad and Socrates is like, yeah, honestly, ever since I hooked up with this guy, he's not letting me like look at anybody else. He's like, can I just breathe? And I'm like, what is happening here, honestly? So I think all of Socrates' little quirks are great. But I think apart from that, one of my favorite definitions of what it means to be a philosopher is from this, and it's the desire thing. You're kind of constantly in between. You're not ignorant, so you know you need wisdom. Mm-hmm. But you don't have wisdom because when you get it, you'll stop looking. And so you're always looking. And that's a lover of wisdom. That's philosophy. That's where we get the word from. And I think that's probably my favorite thing ever in the Symposium.
That's lovely.
That is such a good definition.
Thank you very much. Right? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Godessa, I have a question for you. And this could serve a transitory point into our next work, Kierkegaard. Yeah.
Yes.
What I find as a big misconception amongst people who don't really have a background in philosophy or an understanding of the works of philosophy and philosophy as a concept itself is they explain to me that philosophy is the study of the meaning of life, which is immensely redundant, in my opinion. Have you encountered this? And if so, how do you navigate away from this idea and into your definition of philosophy?
I think that is a tough question because it does depend on what you're looking at in terms of philosophy. So I was at a lecture the other day on kind of ancient Chinese philosophy. And one interesting point that came up was that there was a clear difference in the reason why the ancient Chinese philosophers needed to do philosophy versus why the Greeks needed to do it. And so Socrates and like the pre-Socratics, they lived at a time of relative peace. Like they were honestly just vibing. That's what they did. You hang out at the bath with your bros and you're just kind of thinking. It's like, oh, this is a rock. But like, why is the rock not an apple? It's like, oh, yeah, that's a good question. Well, maybe the apple is this and the rock is this. And it's very like, what are we doing here? And so it does get into this meaning of life thing. It's like, yeah, what does it mean to be like a person? Like, why is a person not a chicken, you know? So, oh yeah, that's right. It's like, what's the meaning of like life? Which can be a very abstract kind of redundant question. But like with the ancient Chinese philosophers, it's like a lot of them came up as statesmen in war. And so their philosophy was like kind of practical. It's like, yo, we're at war. We're trying to like negotiate contracts and peace and political philosophy. And it wasn't as abstract as kind of what some of the Greeks had going on. And so there wasn't a whole lot of meaning of life stuff there because that's what their time and place necessitated because philosophy responds to what you need to figure out as a person. And so I think in this day and age, I do happen to think the meaning of life question is relevant again. And there is a lot that we can do in trying to figure out what we're doing here as young people in this crazy world that's like just so weird. what's really the meaning of personhood and all of that jazz. So there is a place for the meaning of life questions. But of course, philosophy isn't just that. That's not all philosophers do. But especially if you're a fan of existentialism, a decent amount of that is kind of meaning of life stuff, which you're a fan. It's more weighty than just thinking about the meaning of life, but ultimately that is a lot of what they're doing. Camus says that that's the most important philosophical question. Like, why should you continue living? I think that's what matters. Nothing else matters.
Is his question, why should you continue living? Or is it, why should you continue living knowing that there's no inherent meaning to life, period? Like, I'm not...
Well, technically, it's, should you commit suicide? That's his question. Yep. And why should you not, basically? Yeah, that's kind of fact. But there really is one important philosophical question, and it is suicide. Because, like, really? Why? Because it's like, we can have all these questions about forms and the meaning of beauty and all of that jazz. None of that matters unless we figure out, why should you even just continue being alive? That's like the most important thing. And so in that sense, meaning of life stuff is certainly part of existentialism. It's more structured than just kind of abstractly pondering, but it's definitely there. And so philosophy, kind of part of the fun, is that it's all of this stuff. If you want to do logic and just spend all your time doing math, if you're into that, then yeah, that's philosophy. I don't see the appeal personally, but you know, to each their own.
Roasted that type of philosophy when I saw you in person.
Yeah, like, yeah.
I think, Aspa, I don't know, I think I had told you that when I did philosophy a little bit in uni in the UK, after doing it in, you know, in the French school in high school, which they teach it in such a particular way, which is really, really nice how they do it. In the UK, they were just like, okay, logic, premise one plus premise two equals conclusion one, literally. And it's like a printout of Descartes and... for the entire year, like what argument plus what argument makes what conclusion. And it's like, okay, this is killing me.
Yeah.
Do they do it like that in the US too?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you guys both study in the US, right?
Yeah. Nice. Where were you?
I was in Texas. Where were you?
Oh, Texas. Nice. How did you end up in
Texas? Where were you?
California.
Oh, nice. I actually went on a sports scholarship and it was beautiful. I was in Austin, nice. So it wasn't the true Texas. Mm. Mm. It was the city of its own.
Aspa is too humble to say she's a record-breaking athlete. Shh.
Story for another day.
Thank you. Clap, clap, clap. Nice. Yeah.
Were you at Berkeley?
No. I'm too dumb to be at Berkeley. I went to a pretty small.
Hell no. Oh, goodness. Where were you? Sorry.
Anyways, I went to a pretty small liberal arts university in Southern California. No one's ever heard of it. But it was nice. I liked it. It was a vibe.
Good. I like that a lot.
Well, it's funny to see how completely different philosophy teaching's is right. In different places. We've all experienced it like in the US way, in the British way, in the French way, kind of in the Greek way a little bit. And it's just, it kind of shows you how important it is how you approach and learn a subject for how much you end up enjoying it and wanting to pursue it further.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I was a philosophy minor. Same. And for that reason, I took that very similar class to you where it was taught in such a different way that I struggled to conceptualize how to put my thoughts into words. And I ended up getting, I think, on the first test, 11 out of 60. And I just could not recover from that. So I ended up having to switch my minors, I'm afraid.
Well, it was like, this is not for me. I'm going
to
go
The thing read was by that myself. it was the amount of work I had to put in to get an 11 out of 60. I was like, I cannot recover from this. There is no much time I can dedicate. Anyway. Yeah.
Philosophy can be weird in school. I wasn't a philosophy major, but kind of the way my school did things, kind of part of the liberal arts thing, is that they included philosophy in almost all of the core subjects. So even like in biology, we were reading Plato for reasons. And so that was kind of my introduction to Socrates. Really nice. Yeah. Yeah. Because like the Mino talks about like, what is truth? Wait, is that it? No, it's, can you teach someone to be virtuous or are they, whatever. One of the questions in there. And so we're doing that in biology. So that was my introduction to Socrates. I was like, yeah, this guy is so annoying. I love him. I love him so much. But like the first philosophy class I ever took, yeah, I wasn't the best student in that class. But that's a different story. I sucked at philosophy when I took my first class. I don't know. I'm just going to get into it. I don't know why.
But now you teach philosophy, right? And history?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I teach history and politics. And right. then I Trojan horse philosophy in there. You do too? History and politics?
Cool. That's what I majored in, yeah. Politics and history.
I majored in history and political thought.
Yeah.
Nice.
I majored in art history.
We're nerds. Yeah.
Outsider.
Good times.
Yeah. I didn't end up using it much.
I'm very glad that they're integrating philosophy into the curriculum because the amount of people who have absolutely no clue, no thinking beyond what they're being taught is shocking. So I'm glad to hear that your university prioritized it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good time.
Good. Anyways. Bring Kierkegaard into
bring
this.
Bring Kierkegaard into it, right.
Kierkegaard, Well, what a guy.
What a guy.
First of all, thank you, Goodessel, for recommending this audiobook about his life. It gave me a little bit of a better. So there's these lectures, I forget what they're called, by, is it Stephen?
Stephen something. Match.
Well, and so that helped me understand Kierkegaard's life, some basic facts, but I tried to read Works of Love and Fear and Trembling. And I think I just need, Desert Island books, basically. Desert Island books is the best way I can put it. Because I did not have the time to linger over every sentence for 15 minutes.
Yeah. Sorry for dropping Kierkegaard on you.
No, I think it was much needed. Because everyone keeps commenting about Kierkegaard on every time we talk about existentialism. They're like, guys, how about Kierkegaard? So it was about time. But could you just run us through his views on love? And I know a big part of it, like he brings religion into it a lot, which you're very familiar with philosophy of religion. I am not really. Yeah. So yeah, you can tell us a bit about it.
It can be hard to do Kierkegaard kind of for this reason, because on some level, his goal is to convince you to be Christian on some level. But at the same time, you can, and a lot of people do, just kind of throw away the Christian part and focus on the existentialism part, which is fine. But I think that it's part of what makes something like Fear and Trembling kind of difficult to go through, because he's using the story of Abraham and Isaac from the Bible and talking about faith and all of that jazz. And so that's just the whole thing. We don't talk about that. But Works of Love is especially interesting. And actually, a question for you two. So one thing that comes up in philosophy of religion, Christian circles, C.S. Lewis kind of popularized this, is the idea that in Greek, there are different words for love.
Oh, yeah.
And it's seen as, more solid than in English, where we have the one word that we use for everything. I was wondering if you guys can kind of talk about what these differences actually are. So like agape, storge, philia, eros. What's the difference between those four?
Things is we don't even realize before it became a thing where, you started seeing Pinterest posts being like, the Greeks have seven different types of love. It's like, oh,
yeah.
Do we?
It's like, we never saw it like that. I don't know if you agree. Because, for example, philia literally means friendship. Storge means affection. So it's kind of, I think part of it is that people romanticize the Greek to an extent where it's like, you guys also have a word for affection. But it is true in a way, like agape and eros is like love. And I guess eros is like, we don't have that in English.
Erotic.
Well, erotic love. But
erotic love.
Yeah.
Yeah, no one really says that.
It's
like, I love you erotically. I love you erotically. Yeah, I don't think people say that. We can cut that part too.
Well, in Greek, to say I'm in love, you say imerotevmenos, which is like erotevmenos comes from eros. So we do integrate that a lot more into the language we use. Yeah, there is much more of a focus on the erotic part of it, right? Storge means affection. What else do we have? Do you remember the words?
Well, agape, which is the God's love for us, is what's used in religious philosophy, but that's basically what we use to say I love, which I like that a lot. That's, in a sense, the most literal form of I love.
Okay, I found one of the infographics that are like, these are all the words in the Greek.
Infographics?
Yes. Let me show Goodessel. Do you see it?
Yep. Nice.
What's this? I don't know what that is. Maybe that's ancient Greek.
Lidos?
I have no clue what this means.
No, I'm not familiar.
Okay, for example, one of them that it mentions is mania. Like, mania in Greek. No, it literally has the exact same definition as in English.
This doesn't seem like a very trustworthy source.
Pragma?
Pragma.
Love pragmatic.
Pragmatic?
Okay, the only one that's kind of interesting here is maybe philaftia, which I guess is ancient Greek because we don't use that. But it means self-love.
Right.
It's very interesting how, I wonder if these were more of a thing in ancient Greek than they are now. For example, it describes storghi as familial love, which now we use more as like just affection and just, yeah, I guess it is kind of familial love, but it can be anything, no? Storghi, how would you take it?
Never thought of it in that sense. Well, more like you said, like the touch, the physical touch, like that kind of affection.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's agapi, which is like selfless love. So the main type of love.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The only reason I bring it up is that is fairly important for Kierkegaard's works of love, because he is trying to argue for agape love over all of the other ones. So his thing is trying to make agape love cool, right? So he's one of the people that would say that love is not an emotion. It's a choice. It's something that you choose to do. And he will say that true love is not based on reasons. So you shouldn't want or need a reason to love anyone. Even if the reason is something that makes sense. If you love them because you think they're beautiful, you love them because they make you feel incredible, whatever it is. In that sense, it's not really, it's a very simple choice because they're giving you reasons. And so real love is loving everyone, even if they give you reasons not to. And it's an interesting point because I think Kierkegaard brings the reasons factor into it, which is a fascinating one. And so another question kind of for you two, now that I think about it. So like, imagine you're like married, you've been married for like 30 years and like you love the person 100%, soulmate, blah, blah, blah. And one day, for whatever reason, you ask them why they love you. What about you? Is it? What would a good answer to that question be? Because it feels like though there are a lot of bad answers for sure. But what would a great answer be?
I think a good answer is probably one that highlights the non-obvious things about you. Maybe.
I was going to say subconsciously as well.
I think that shows deeper knowing. And that's probably a good thing. But, you know, I can think of bad answers, but it's harder to tell exactly why a good answer would be good. What do you guys think?
Yeah.
I don't think I'd be able to describe why I love someone. It's something that's very subconscious. There's a subconscious knowing that I'm not aware of. I cannot explain it.
Sometimes you just try to put it into words, but it's like kind of futile. And it's almost as if it's pointless trying. Yeah. I think sometimes it's like that. Obviously, you can always highlight things that maybe your favorite qualities in a person. And that's always nice, but ultimately, I don't think that's why you love them. I think it comes maybe from the soul, or you get what I mean? It's what Aspa said. It's more subconscious and internal than anything you can rationalize. What do you think?
What do you think?
Yeah. Turning the question around.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's such a weird thing to think about because on the one hand, I can imagine someone asking somebody this question, asking their partner this question, and then being a bit upset that they can't give an answer. Because, I mean, it being subconscious in the heart, that's nice, but it feels like not the best answer. But it does, even if it is true, right, it does seem like all the other answers also kind of suck. Like you could be super superficial and say that, oh, it's because you like the way they look. That's a horrible answer. Sure. But even if it's something like, oh, it's because of, and you make me feel so warm inside or whatever, that also feels
a bit
kind of not great. Yeah. It feels not great, which is unfortunate. So it's almost like going back to the soulmate thing. It's almost like you want them to say something about you that you just didn't know. And I think this is where existentialism kind of shows up and punches you in the face, because you kind of want someone to want you for you, but like you don't even know what you are.
Yeah.
And so you kind of expect somebody else to, in a way, which is which is very odd. And so, yeah, and so I can't really, it's almost like by definition, the best answer is one that you can't even really think about yet. Because like any answer that I can think of just doesn't seem like, this doesn't seem like a good answer. And so Kierkegaard will say that, yeah, you know, reasons, it shouldn't be about reasons. And even that seems not great, because if you tell your partner that, like, yeah, I love you because, you know, God wants us to love everyone, and I love everyone equally, you know, so I love you, and I love this guy on the street just as much. And then play, yeah, and then it's just like, that sucks. But it's almost what Kierkegaard is getting at here. It's this love for everyone equally. And at that point, it sounds like the symposium business. You have a love for beauty itself. And there are different ways to read Kierkegaard on this, but I think that this is probably the most, I guess, surface level thing in works of love. And I just find it interesting because it introduces the whole reasons question. Like, what's the reason that somebody loves somebody else? And are there good reasons? Are there bad reasons? Like, what does it mean to want someone to want you for you? Like, that's such a, it's such an abstract thing. But yeah, that's kind of a bit of what Kierkegaard has going on.
It was also the point in the symposium where they discussed attraction to men versus women. I could be pushing it a little bit more, but inherently when you're attracted to men, you inherently need to be attracted to someone virtuously because of their mind, their intellect, over their physical appearance, right? And so by inherently being attracted to men who at the time were considered the superior, the smarter, you were inherently more virtuous. Whereas if you liked, that's what I'm trying to say.
It's they were like hilarious.
They were like, obviously, if you're attracted to men, it's because of intellect. So you're kind of, you've got it figured out. If you're attracted to women.
It's like that's a bit sus. Like, what's wrong with you? It's like, women, that's weird.
But I think the part where this kind of seems similar to me is where they say in the symposium that if you see, I don't remember who says it, and I guess it's one of the key ideas, so we might as well bring it up. But if you love someone because of reasons, or especially because of some type of beauty, then you're quote-unquote foolish to not see that that beauty exists in everyone else too, in different forms. So you might as well love everyone. And that seems kind of similar to Kierkegaard in kind of calling out that pickiness people have and just raising the higher form of love where you just love everyone equally because they all share that humanity.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
I think once more it kind of comes down to, I don't know, is if this is your cup of tea, I suppose, does it really make sense to remove the exclusivity aspect of love and make it into a universal thing? On the one hand, I mean, sure, I think that's a great thing. I think it would be better if we all loved everyone around us. But the idea that that's real love and love based on any type of choices that might be between, say, two people is kind of to the wayside. I think I can kind of imagine that not sitting well with a lot of people. But I think bringing the existentialism into it all again, Sartre kind of makes a point on this. Like, love is really this thing of despair, because love, in order for it to be love, needs to have freedom. And you want the person you love to be completely free so that they can choose you. And then the love is real. But with this freedom comes the possibility that they'll peace out at some point. This is why the reasons thing is weird, because it's like, if someone gives you reasons, it feels as though that also means that the reasons can change. And you almost don't want them to be able to vocalize why. Because it's like, these are the reasons why. If these things are no longer there, I'm going to peace out. And so there's this existential dread around the freedom of love that Sartre talks about. And it kind of is in line with this whole reasons thing that Kierkegaard has going on. And it's interesting.
I love that, actually. It's very interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but it's true that if someone gives you reasons, then it feels almost like too much pressure in a way for you to live up to what they think you are and kind of see yourself through that love, which can quickly get weird if you don't have a very strong sense of who you are already. And what I found interesting with Kierkegaard is that he thinks that managing to love, especially those that we consider unworthy of love, is it leads us to a truer kind of love because it forces us to extend compassion beyond the limits of attraction and what we naturally want to love. So I see why you would say that's a truer kind of love, because it sheds a lot of the ego and that and the, you know, that kind of picky part of it.
Yeah.
How, you know, I feel about it realistically, but I do see his point. Good point.
Kierkegaard is, I can't with that guy. I keep saying this, but really? He's literally my favorite.
Does he give you the ick?
I mean, kind of, but low key, I get that. Like, kind of with Socrates, I'm a Kierkegaard fanboy. I have, he's my favorite philosopher, I'm, like, tied up there with, like, a few other people.
That's annoying. Just, there's something about that. Like,
that's part of the appeal. Before actually reading Kierkegaard, it's fun to like look him up on Goodreads, to like AZ quotes, whatever. Like look up just random Kierkegaard quotes. And you'll just be like, dang, like what was this man going through? It makes you want to try to figure it out. Then you actually read the work and you're like, I am so confused right now. But you know what? I think you can kind of make sense of it. But yeah, this is kind of Kierkegaard's thing on loving everyone.
He sees preferential love as selfish. Do you think preferential love is selfish?
Yeah, but not like in a bad way. I don't think it's in a bad way, no. But yeah. I think there is an element of selfishness to it. Again, I love my my hypothetical partner more than the random guy next to me on the bus. Like, I don't know. That's kind of how it goes. And it doesn't mean I hate the random guy next to me, but I give preference to this person, then it's because they make me feel more than the random guy on the bus does.
I think it's interesting to look at that part where they make you feel more than the random guy, because from what I understood from my brief attempt at Kierkegaard is that he thinks that neighbor love, where you just, you know, loving everyone based on your shared humanity, is loving them for their own good, while the romantic love concept that we follow is more because we like being drawn to someone, because we enjoy it, because they make us feel a certain way.
I'm having an intellectual crisis right now.
Nice.
This is so interesting. And if anything, it's making me think, how am I ever going to get to onboard all of the topics of all times, you know?
Like, how am I going to learn everything?
This has unlocked levels in my brain. And I'm like, I have so much to say and ask.
A lot of questions. That's incredible.
Then say, ask.
But I can only think about my corporate job that starts in 40 minutes.
Oh my God.
Oh goodness. Cool. So could you tell us, because I onboarded the either or. So I took more of the Kierkegaard approach towards anxiety and, you know, his study on the human condition. I don't quite understand if any of his works on anxiety lead to love. Is there any link to it that he unpacks, or not so much?
I mean, on some level, sure. But again, this is why Kierkegaard is the worst. Because he does do a lot of pseudonyms. So he writes as different people. That's like his thing. Works of Love, interestingly, I think he wrote under his own name, which kind of says a bit about what's going on there. But a lot of his works, he just makes up characters. And so on some level, all of his works are kind of facing in their own direction, because he wasn't a fan of like systems. That's kind of why he had beef with Hegel. I mean, there's a bunch of reasons why, but that's a different conversation.
Yeah, beef with a lot of people.
Yeah, beef with a lot of people. And so there's like a set of his works that are trying to make Christians be more Christian. And so there's like a set of writings that are super into that. But on some level, he wouldn't have liked to be systemized. But at the same time, I think obviously they all do kind of link together. And so when he talks about anxiety and freedom and all of that jazz, I guess I could see it kind of linking into the love stuff. But it's a good question, but it's a difficult question. There's probably people better at Kierkegaard than me that could answer it.
Thank you.
Should we segue into
White Knights,
more of existentialist love, into White Knights, which, Godeslam, I'm very glad you read for this episode.
I did.
What did you think? You sent me your two gift reactions, and they spoke for themselves, honestly.
Yeah, so I started reading the text, the words. Then I switched to the audiobook. And I was walking down the street. And I was like, I paused at one point. I like took off my headphones and just like stared at the sky for a few minutes. I was like, okay, well, this is happening. That's fine. And at one moment, I was like standing at a traffic light. And it was green, but I just stood there because I was listening to the story. This story is just doing, and on some level, I mean, I knew how it was going to end. This is Dostoevsky. I know how this is going to end. It's not going to be pretty, but I can't do this. And then when it happens, when she runs into the guy and then she pieces out, I was just like, it just happened so quickly too. And then the final chapter, just the last little monologue, that was incredible. That was incredible. I loved it. 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10.
So the ending, the monologue, that resonated a lot with you?
I think a lot of it kind of resonated in different ways. I do tend to be a bit head in the clouds a lot. I like being up in the clouds. You know, it's pretty nice up there. They're all fluffy and, you know, and stuff. But I think that this idea of kind of being a dreamer who just kind of walks through the town in his own head. That's literally me since moving to London. I
can relate. Me too.
So, London's a great place to do it.
It is a really great place to do it.
That's really sweet. I love that.
Well, actually, another question, and now that I think about it for you too. There's the saying that you can never say the wrong thing to the right person. It's an interesting one. But I was interested in this story because the two characters meet, and like in their second meeting ever, he literally pours out his whole life to her. And I wonder if that rule, that saying can apply to this situation. Like if, again, another hypothetical for you all, you meet someone for the first time, it's a date, it's all right. And this is like the first conversation you have. It's like stupidly deep or whatever. Is this like in 99% of the time, is this just a red flag? Or is there a possibility of it being the right person?
I genuinely like when that happens because it means that it somehow wasn't forced. And I think that when it happens naturally, it can be beautiful because it just means that you're connecting in more of a special way. And kind of, why not? And I do want to believe, as a chronic overthinker, that you can't say the wrong thing to the right person. So I want to believe that. How about you?
Okay, that's nice. I think there's two levels of it. Mm-hmm. One of them is you're either spilling out on ideas and thoughts that you're having, and then there's the other side, which is more of like you're spilling out your problems and your issues and your innocence and kind of looking to unload your burdens. So I think there's a difference there. But I don't think it's a red flag. I think it certainly is a situation where in order to feel the ability to do so, you kind of have to have this feeling of comfort and things need to come together and feel right for you to get to that stage. So to answer your question, no, it's not a red flag.
Which one of those two do you think the narrator does in the story?
The burden, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It doesn't feel like, well, in his case, I feel he jumped into it maybe a bit too quickly. Mm. I think he was really looking for a connection. Mm-hmm. So he saw her name, Nastenka, and he was like, her, I will.
He was immensely lonely.
He was like, let's follow her around and tell her about my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though they did share a beautiful connection. But I think it's when it comes to a person that is, as you said, immensely lonely, maybe can come from the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
So it kind of depends on how well you are doing with yourself. And then that relates to how you start connecting with other people in that sense.
Yeah.
But so how do you think, like for you, how did White Nights capture love? For me, one of the main things I got from it is just the fact that a beautiful experience of love is, it gives enough meaning to your life that it almost doesn't matter the outcome. It's beautiful if you manage to be in the present, and no matter what happens, you are lucky enough to have had that beautiful experience. And that's enough meaning. Like, you can find enough meaning in that. I do really like that.
Mm.
I love what you just said. And I think another element that I would add would be you don't feel the need to explain it to anyone else. It doesn't feel like you have to justify it by no means. If it makes sense to you, then it makes sense to you, full stop.
The love, the meaning.
The love, the meaning. Mm-hmm. The love, particularly.
That's cute.
The situation.
Yeah.
You don't feel the need to explain it, mm-hmm. that I met the love of my life in 5 days and we've never seen each other again.
Sounds like a YouTube clickbait title.
It really
I met the love of my life in 5 days and we haven't seen each other again.
Yeah. Yeah. Nastenka, that would be her, honestly, if she lived right now. Yeah.
If Nastenka was a TikToker, yeah.
Yeah. Get ready with me to like wait on this bench for but oh god, it's a mess.
That's actually so funny.
Oh goodness.
Yeah.
Oh my god, yeah. I'll be making TikToks like that.
That would that'd be ridiculous. But yeah. Definitely agree with what you two have said. It's such an interesting story. I think it definitely captures the weirdness of love, to the complexity of it all. Because like every word that Nastenka says, the narrator, it's just so fascinating to me. Because she's like, you're better than this guy. You know, why can't you be him? Or why can't he be you? Like, there is this love. And she's literally like, he could be a friend of like the both of us. Like the three of us could hang out together forever. And I'm like, okay, that's a bit much. That's a bit too much. But I think it is a very real description of how these things go sometimes, because you can love someone and for whatever reason, you just love someone else or you just love them more. You love them in that way. And that's just kind of how it is. And so I think that the way the narrator, that's kind of why the last speech is so interesting to me, because he almost like relives some of his fears of like dying alone and being in solitude for the rest of his life. And he's like, you can imagine that, but like to imagine being upset with her.
Yes.
He just can't. And that got me.
Yeah. He was like to imagine upsetting her on her, you know, special day or whatever.
Yeah.
Like could never. And it's like,
that's
beautiful. That it feels like a selfless, well, you said that it ended badly, the book, and it's almost like, well, the optimistic romantic in me is like, I don't think that's that bad.
Yeah.
Because
the
whole point Dostoevsky manages to make in such a short time is that, to put it very cliche, it's about the journey, not the destination. But he captures it in a beautiful way. And it's, well, I really do like it, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's very well done. What do you think?
Spot on. I forget we're on a podcast, so I have to speak.
Yeah.
You guys have me head in the clouds now. I've been thinking so much. Everything and everything.
Thoughts on White Nights, love?
That specifically, thoughts on, as of right now, like, is there inherent suffering in love?
I love that question. Because, like, I've been thinking, how about suffering in love? No, because such a big question.
I also, because I don't know if, I don't think I told you this, but I am half Russian.
I keep forgetting that.
I know, I do too.
Wow.
And then I remember that, like, and my mother grew up thinking that, like, there was purpose in suffering. And so I keep seeing that in Dostoevsky's writing. And to me, some of it's unnecessary, but comparatively speaking, in regard to other works of love, I do see the tendency for suffering and not fetishizing suffering, but giving it purpose.
Romanticizing
it in the sense of like, yes, definitely so.
Interesting. Mm. Do you see that in White Nights?
Mm-hmm, very much so. This guy is suffering.
Yeah.
He's suffering.
Uh-huh. He is suffering, honestly. He is going through it by all means.
Mm.
Yeah. Hmm.
What are you thinking? By all means, you agree.
Yeah. No. I do agree. It's worth to say. It reminds me of kind of back in the day, a friend of mine was like, what was happening? He was into this girl and like wanted to let her know, but he couldn't. But he was just kind of wallowing into despair. And so I was like, bro, just like put it all out on the line.
Yes.
If she rejects you, like you're already suffering, but like, you know, there'll be meaning to it. And so there is something to be said about like meaning to the suffering, and to those who like ascribe that to love, I think the justification is like, if there's anything worth suffering for, it's probably going to have to be love, because it kind of, because suffering can be meaningless. I was thinking about the trial the other day, Kafka's trial. And it's like, I mean, spoiler alert, but I mean, that just ends like,
yeah.
Like, what was the point?
We had a whole episode discussing our first.
Yeah. I've listened to it. Good job.
Have you really?
Yeah. I actually started it and then waited to read the trial and then I finished it.
Oh, lovely.
We're glad.
So nice. Yeah. So there can be suffering in that sense where it's just like, what are we literally doing here? I think there is a part of suffering that is that sometimes it just happens. But I think when it has a meaning, if there's anything that is worth suffering for, I think love's probably a great candidate. And so that's probably why we kind of gravitate to the suffering and love stereotypes a lot.
Yeah, I think that what you said is very interesting in that regard. Like, if you're going to suffer for love anyway, you might as well suffer for the right reasons. Like, you might as well make it more meaningful by putting your love out there, staying true to yourself. And then if you suffer because of rejection, literally you're still suffering, so you might as well. Like, what's the difference between, well, we tend to think that suffering from love is easier than suffering from rejection, but is it really? And I think you genuinely are doing yourself a favor by putting your love and staying true to yourself, putting that out there. Yeah, you might as well shoot your shot. That's what I mean.
That's what this whole podcast is about. No, shoot your shot, really. That's you.
Shoot your shot, right. Life is inherently irrational.
Like, the journey itself is enriching. Truly, it is. No matter what happens,
really?
The journey is such an enriching experience, no matter the outcome. So it's not, well, it's rarely ever that bad of a thing if all you did was follow your instincts to express your love. That's what I think.
Mm.
I've just become more and more hedonist. Like,
really?
Oh, goodness, yes.
In what way?
In the way of the more I read and the more I'm just like, there is meaninglessness and purposelessness, and I will never get to the bottom of like why we've been put on this earth. So I've been turning towards, you know, like more pleasureful experiences and filling my days with those.
That's nice.
And I understand that there's times that, you know, there's going to be elements that aren't pleasant, and to that I just let it be. And when I'm able to immerse myself in more pleasurable experience, I tend to do so. I don't deprive myself of them, because I certainly, there is an element of not stigma, but like, we as a society tend to reinforce or praise people who like
deny their pleasure
and look at them and say, like, goodness, you're so
stoicism against desire.
exactly
yeah.
Guys, I think we've made a lot of points.
I love this. I cannot wait.
Yeah.
Like, even off mic, I would love to just hang out and talk. This is very enriching.
Yeah.
I did not think
let's
I
hang
was
out and talk.
Friday morning. Yeah, let's hang out and talk. I'm very, very, I would love to hear more of your thoughts.
Me too. This is such a fun discussion.
Oh,
I love
just,
it.
Oh my goodness.
It's like a rainy Friday morning in Athens. It's really just...
This is what the symposium is all about. Have you been to
Greece? This is what it's all about.
There you go.
Yeah, it really is. This is the most enjoyable thing ever.
We talked about this, I'm planning on showing up over the summer-ish, like in June. That's the plan.
You're coming?
That's the plan. It's not official yet, but I'm working on it.
We will book a library.
We're
going to
have a little symposium
so
in Athens.
That's the goal. I really genuinely want to do that. I genuinely want to have a
Let's make it happen.
And bring people with bright ideas. Just discuss.
Yeah. There's a really cute quote. I feel like I need to do justice from the symposium that says, love is so skilled a poet that he makes others into poets. Well, he in symposium is love. So it says, love is so skilled a poet that he makes others into poets. Everyone turns into a poet when he's touched by love, even though a stranger to the muses before. I think that's really cute.
Yeah.
I like that. And then that it's something like, love's beauty of complexion is shown by the fact that he spends his time among flowers. How cute is that?
That's adorable. Mm.
Like, why would you say that, Agathon? That he really he delivered.
Yeah. That's a nice one.
It is a nice
that's
one.
A nice
yeah.
one.
Do you have any book recommendations, any author recommendations for our listeners, perhaps?
I definitely would recommend reading Plato's Dialogues, honestly. Just there are a lot of nice audiobook recordings of them that kind of make it into like a dramatic reading. So it's like an actual play. You get to hear people do stuff. So like in the symposium that I listen to, like people clap after the stuff.
Oh, no way. When,
yeah, right. And so like, what's his face has the hiccups.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, I still don't know why that's in there. I'm like, okay, that's fine, I guess.
And it's like, you go next because I have the hiccups right now. And it's like, what was the point of putting that in
the book? Like, it's like, literally, why? But it's incredible. So I would, and so yeah, I'd definitely recommend listening to them is nice just to kind of get into more of Socrates. Because Socrates really is just a super important figure. You don't have to agree that he's the ideal philosopher, but I think the fact that Plato thinks so and Plato has touched a lot of philosophy in the world today. It's just nice to see what Socrates had going on. His apology, the speeches he gives before his death. Yeah, I think it's the apology and the Phaedo. Don't quote me on that, but I think those two are about his death. And then most of them are just him, again, annoying everyone with his questions. I think those are pretty cool.
The Platonic dialogues, okay.
No.
Yeah.
The Republic, I read that for my degree and I loved it.
Did you really?
Yeah, for uni.
Well, not all of it, not cover to cover, but extracts of it. Yeah. Did you read it too? The Republic?
Yeah. For great also work. For my degree. Yeah.
There you go.
It's nice.
We're all living the same life.
It's not bad. I know, spooky.
Oh,
you can barely tell us apart.
Oh, you mentioned C.S. Lewis, that I absolutely love C.S. Lewis.
I did.
There's this C.S. Lewis idea that is very interesting to me that we can expand one day if we do a philosophy episode on this, but it's basically that he says that joy is a state of almost having something, and joy is basically a state of wanting and not quite having. And I've thought about this so much. I've tried to write a little essay on it, and then I just always never quite know how to even argue for every side. I find it such an interesting philosophical question. It's like, it's about how there's sometimes more joy in the desire than in the possession.
Yeah.
And I just find myself keep coming back to this. It's very interesting. I've never read anything by his.
Yeah. I think C.S. Lewis is kind of like Kierkegaard in the sense in that, again, his mission deep down is to kind of make you super like Christianity. That's like his thing. But
I'm trying to convert
I think
you.
His but I think his writing is so beautiful because obviously he has such a vivid imagination because he writes fantasy stories, and you can just tell in his writing that he obviously has a way with words, and he just has a way of sparking the imagination in super beautiful ways that you can get so entranced by it that you don't even know if you're being entranced by him or by Christianity. It's kind of who really knows. And so I think that's one of the reasons why his works kind of can stand on their own. You don't need to believe in what he has going on to kind of be sucked into the fantasy. Yeah, he has some nice ones. He has one called, I think, The Great Divorce, which is good. It's kind of about like people, like what heaven and hell is. I'll just put it that way. Well, he puts it in this super interesting way.
Well, that's, I guess, one of our next reads. We have a lot to read.
This is officially our longest episode yet, but I think honestly my favorite one so far.
Nice. Thank you.
Yeah.
It was so much fun. You guys do super cool work. Thank you for having me.
So do you.
You do incredible work. Thank you for creating, you know, such an incredible and digestible way of understanding philosophy.
It's really
wonderful. It's really captivating, and it's your students are blessed to have you. Seriously. What is your TikTok? Because I don't have TikTok, but I know of you from TikTok.
Nice. So I think my name, you'll find me just with my name, Godesulo.
I love that you're like
exactly how it's pronounced.
Social media.
Incredible. Yep. It's just me.
Well, it's a blessing, I think.
It is. It is. Yeah. I plan on naming my kids just the weirdest stuff ever, you know.
Yeah, same. You get a lot of good domains. I'm like, oh, erifili.net available. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Baspa.
Yeah.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for joining us. This was such a fun discussion. Yeah, can't wait to discuss more in person all together. And we're going to link all of your stuff below so people can follow you.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
Take care. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.